Restoring the Caliphate, today, Wednesday, June 25th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The ISIS extremists fighting in Iraq say they want to reestablish an Islamic state known as the Caliphate, but they may not realize how freewheeling the old Caliphate actually was.
There was wine and drinking and poetry, and it was very different, I think, than what ISIS has in mind.
And later, they say New England weather is unpredictable, but this farmer is learning to cope with new weather patterns linked to climate change.
These downpours, like last week, we had an inch of rain in about 10 or 15 minutes. I mean, it was just obnoxious.
Plus, how one Uruguayan reacted when he saw his country's star soccer player bite an opponent at the World Cup.
Oh, he was not again, not again.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We've got a lot of news to get to today, including a certain biting incident at the World Cup that demands our attention. Let's start in Iraq, though, since the crisis there began, or began again, with the Sunni insurgent group ISIS taking over major cities in Iraq. We've been fielding some of your questions about what's going on. And one of the questions I've had relates to something ISIS has been declaring. They say they want to establish a caliphate. You've heard the word, right? Caliphate, a sort of Muslim domain ruled by a caliph. So let's start there today. What is a caliphate? Tariq Masood is going to help us tackle this one. He focuses on the politics of religion in the Islamic world at Harvard's Kennedy School.
Basically, the caliph or khalifa is a political office that was established after the death of the Prophet Muhammad in the beginning of the 7th century. And there's been an unbroken chain of caliphs going all the way back from that period all the way until 1924, when the caliph was then situated in Istanbul and the caliphate was ended by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the leader of Turkey, after that country's defeat in the First World War. So it's this long-standing political institution that had always united Muslims.
Right. So that last caliphate was the Ottoman Empire, which I'm sure a lot of our listeners know well. And there is not a caliphate today, correct?
No. Atatürk basically felt that in order to bring his country, Turkey, into the modern world, it had to get rid of all of these old Islamic institutions. And so he said, look, you know, we're not going to have the caliphate here. And then basically the caliphate was never taken up anywhere else. And so 1924 is the end of this institution. And it kind of is seen by a lot of people across the Middle East, mainly Islamists, as the sort of principal political calamity to have befallen Muslims in the last 1,500 years. I mean, I remember as a kid, my father telling me that this was the moment of great tragedy for Muslims, that they had once been united, and then this office that united them was destroyed.
I mean, even your father, did he feel that there was indeed unity across the Muslim world because of a caliphate?
Look, the caliphate has this attraction to people because, remember, this is a period of great Muslim empires. Every dynasty that held the caliphate controlled massive tracts of land stretching across continents. So this was a period where Muslims really were contenders for great power in the world, and the Muslim empires had reached almost to the gates of Europe. And so that period is very alluring to people. There's also this idea of the caliphate, or particularly in the caliphate's early years, the first 30 years of the caliphate, as embodying the purest, most just government that Muslims have ever experienced. So there's that attraction too.
Wow. So it's about power on one hand, but it's also about justice. I mean, how do you see ISIS using the phrase caliphate?
Well, if you look at caliphates in Muslim history, you know, they probably weren't the kinds of institutions that ISIS had in mind. So, for example, if any of your listeners have read The Arabian Nights, you know, it's basically set in the court of the Abbasid caliph, Harun al-Rashid, in the 8th century. And there was wine and drinking and poetry. And it was very different, I think, than what ISIS has in mind. But ISIS, I think, is a part of this intellectual tradition in the Muslim world to restore the unity of Muslims, and that sees the dissolution of the caliphate as the result of Western intervention. And so I think that's what ISIS wants. Now, ISIS also doesn't just want Muslim unity. It also has a particular vision for how Muslims should be governed, and that is by the very strict application of a very retrograde form of Sharia law. And I think if you look at the history of Islamic caliphates, that's not really a part of it, but it's certainly part of what ISIS wants to do.
And is a caliphate a concept that all Muslim sects kind of accept, as Sunnis and Shiites see eye to eye on the idea of a caliphate?
Oh, no, that's a great question. In fact, the big cleavage in that, you know, most of our listeners are probably aware of between Sunnis and Shias actually came about in the 7th century as a result over a dispute over who gets to be the caliph.
Oh, no kidding.
So for Shiites, they believe that the caliphate belongs to the family of the Prophet Muhammad, that there's an unbroken line of imams, and only those people who are chosen by God and who are from the bloodline of the Prophet have the right to be the caliph, whereas Sunni Muslims don't believe that. And in fact, Sunnis have accepted caliphates that were basically dynasties from different families.
I'm just curious to hear from you, Tariq, what kind of conversations you're hearing among practicing Muslims about the way ISIS seems to be freely using the word caliphate.
For most Muslims today, the caliphate isn't something that they think about on a daily basis. It was probably much more relevant for people of, you know, sort of my father's and grandfather's generation. But today, Muslims generally accept the majority of Muslims and the majority of Arabs generally accept the legitimacy of the nation states that they inhabit. And certainly, to the extent that they don't like their nation states, it's not that they're looking for bigger ones. They may be looking for smaller ones. So I don't think that anybody is necessarily thinking that ISIS is appropriating a term that belongs to all Muslims. I have heard among, you know, what we might call moderate Islamists, that what we're seeing today with ISIS, Osama bin Laden too, right? Osama bin Laden, if you read his writings, restoring the caliphate was a central aim. Mm. That, in fact, if there had been a caliphate, that it would have been a bulwark against this kind of extremism, because you would have this figure who could speak for Muslims and who could say that these extreme interpretations of Islam or these extreme political movements are beyond the pale of Islam. And that in the absence of that, it's basically opened up the door to these extremists.
And what do you think, Tariq? Do you think the world of Islam needs a legitimate kind of caliph today?
Well, I don't think that. I think that what the world of Islam needs and what the entire world needs is to move forward rather than look backwards. I think what we're seeing today is something that we'd probably see regardless of whether we had something called a caliph or not. What we're really looking at is the result of sort of weak states and groups that want to establish control in areas that are ungoverned. And whether you have a caliph or not isn't going to change that fundamental dynamic.
Well, Tariq Masood at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, thanks so much for answering these questions.
Thanks, Marco.
As I said earlier, we've been asking you for your questions about the crisis in Iraq, and we've gotten a lot of really great ones. And while we try to answer some on the radio every day, we also got some online help today from Nabi Boulos. He covers Iraq and the Mideast for the LA Times. And today he answered many of your Iraq questions during a Q&A on our Facebook page. One participant wanted to know where the money comes from to support the ISIS militants. Nabi replied it came from Qatar at first, but now may involve an ancient system called hawalas, which he said does not involve the actual movement of money. That's something we here in the world's newsroom want to find out a lot more about, so stay tuned for that. Meanwhile, check out the whole chat and ask us more of your questions about Iraq at facebook.com/PRI the world. President Obama has also been getting a lot of questions about Iraq lately. Last week, he answered some at the White House. And when he talked about possible models for a solution to the crisis in Iraq, he compared the country to another nation in the region.
You look at a country like Yemen, a very impoverished country, and one that has its own sectarian or ethnic divisions.
Wait a minute. Did President Obama just compare it to Yemen? I mean, some Middle East watchers did a double take, and one of them was BuzzFeed's national security fellow, Gregory Johnson. He's an expert on Yemen. Gregory, we hear the Yemeni government can't control the extremists there. They've taken lots of heat for the drone program. Why would the president consider Yemen a good model for Iraq?
That's really a great question. I think what's happening is that for the U.S., it looks like Yemen's a success story, and President Obama wants to export what a lot of U.S. officials are calling the Yemen model, which is basically drones and some special forces advisors onto Iraq and hopefully control the militant groups there. The problem with that is what the U.S. is doing in Yemen isn't even working in Yemen. About 4.5 years ago, when the U.S. started this program of drone strikes, special forces advisors on the ground, Al-Qaeda in Yemen numbered about 200 or 300 people. Now, today, there's several thousand people. So what the U.S. is doing in Yemen isn't working. And the militant group in Iraq, ISIS, is a much different organization than Al-Qaeda in Yemen.
Right. Now, you've also pointed out that the history and the terrain of the two places is vastly different. Start by unpacking the terrain. Why is that important?
Right. So in Yemen, what you have is a very rough, a very mountainous country. So Al-Qaeda is up in the hills. They're largely away from civilian centers. But even being as isolated as they are out in the hills, the U.S. has had a very difficult task in actually conducting good strikes. So the U.S. has, in 2010, mistakenly killed the deputy governor of a province. In 2012, they mistakenly killed several civilians. In late 2013, they actually hit a wedding convoy instead of an Al-Qaeda convoy. They've destroyed Bedouin villages instead of terrorist training camps. The problem for the U.S. is if they can't even hit the right targets in Yemen when the targets are isolated, how do they hope to hit the right targets in Iraq when the targets are sort of cheek and jowl with the civilians there? Look, the United States has been in war in the Middle East for more than 13 years now, since September 11th. And what's happening is that U.S. officials are looking at Yemen, and instead of seeing the reality on the ground, which is what they're doing isn't working, they're seeing success. And they're so desperate for success that they're willing to take the little bit that they think they have in Yemen and try to export it to Iraq. Unfortunately, it's not going to work, and it's going to make what's happening in Iraq much, much worse, because drone strikes are just not capable of doing what the U.S. wants them to do in Iraq, which is to uproot the Sunni militant group that is taking over these cities.
So despite the failings of U.S. strategy in Yemen, President Obama called Yemen's President Hadi a committed partner. Is it obvious how Yemen's president has helped the U.S.?
Yeah, so basically what President Obama means by committed is a compliant partner. He's basically saying, look, President Hadi has allowed us to do whatever it is that we want to do within Yemen. The problem for comparing Yemen to Iraq and what the U.S. is trying to do and take this Yemen model and graft it onto Iraq is that you don't have the same sort of compliant partner in Nouri al-Maliki, the president of Iraq, that you have in the president of Yemen. Maliki is someone who's very close to Iran and is someone that President Obama and U.S. officials have actually been looking to sort of push out in Iraq. It just seems as though the U.S. doesn't have a very good grasp of A, what's happening on the ground in Yemen, B, what's happening on the ground in Iraq, or C, how to solve either of these problems.
Sounds like you're choosing C.
Yeah, the administration, unfortunately, needs a very carefully tailored approach to both of these. And what the U.S. is trying to do right now, at least in my opinion, is solve incredibly complex problems with a low-cost, low-risk option. And these simple and pat solutions, unfortunately, aren't going to do anything to either roll back ISIS in Iraq or to contain Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, the group based in Yemen.
Gregory Johnson, the National Security Fellow at BuzzFeed and author of The Last Refuge, Yemen, Al-Qaeda, and America's War in Arabia. Gregory, thank you.
Thanks so much, Marco.
Still to come on The World, is it polite to play soccer when your mouth is full? We'll get to the bottom of the bite heard round the globe on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI and supported by TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen, available at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Responding to climate change will mean changing the way we do a lot of things, from really big to really small. You can see the scope of those challenges reflected in President Obama's climate initiatives. There are big, high-profile initiatives, like his plan to curb greenhouse pollution from power plants. That's a new plan. And then there are smaller efforts to engage people at a grassroots level, where they live and work. The World's Jason Margolis is going to tell us about one effort called a climate hub. It's a program to help farmers around the United States cope with the effects of climate change.
Terry Jones strolls through his fields of Christmas trees, digging up the remains of old stumps planted by Joneses before him.
It's sort of reverting back to soil.
The Joneses have been farming this land in Connecticut since the 1850s. Terry is generation number 5. The Joneses are still here in large part because they've adapted with the times.
The dairy cows left in the 1960s. My dad started the Christmas tree business. He never liked the cows as much as he liked the trees. And I came along and started growing vegetables and strawberries and blueberries.
His son has added wine grapes. Changes on the farms have mostly been driven by the marketplace, but Jones says future changes will also surely be dictated by the increasingly erratic weather.
For instance, I've been growing and harvesting strawberries for 50 years. This is the first season that we have not had a single frost.
That's actually been a benefit. But Jones has also seen more invasive plants and pests, as well as unpredictably warmer and wetter weather.
These downpours, like last week, we had an inch of rain in about 10 or 15 minutes. I mean, it was just obnoxious.
Jones is experimenting with new soils and mulch to help absorb these downpours. He and his son, an Ivy League grad, are pretty savvy modern farmers. But when it comes to dealing with climate change, Jones says they're kind of making things up as they go. He says when local farmers like him learned that the feds were opening a climate hub in New England, they said, great idea. Then, what's a climate hub?
And I realize that people may not immediately understand what a hub is.
Bill Hohenstein is the man behind the hubs. Officially, he directs the Climate Change Program Office at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Under his guidance, the USDA is setting up 10 regional hubs affiliated with state land-grant colleges.
The Southeast hub is in North Carolina, in Raleigh. The Midwest hub is in Ames, Iowa.
I met Hohenstein at the Northeast hub in Durham, New Hampshire. The
Southern Plains hub is in Oklahoma.
It's understandable to forget one. The hubs were only announced in February and are still getting their footing. The idea is to get the latest science on this global problem out to USDA workers and farmers at the most local level.
We've got staff all over the country. We've got offices in 3,000 counties. The hubs are going to try to give them sort of the systematic, scientific, our best understanding of climate change options they have to manage risks and to also agriculture as a source of greenhouse gas emissions.
I think they have the potential to be a great idea.
That's Joe Casola of the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions, a think tank in Washington. He says the climate hubs are based on a tried and true model to help farmers. 100 years ago, Congress created a partnership between the USDA and land-grant colleges across the nation called the Cooperative Extension Service.
And if we can create through these hubs something that looks like the Extension Service, but that is supplying climate information, I think there's a potential to really get folks ahead of some of the impacts as opposed to responding to them after the fact.
Some farm groups have expressed concern that the hubs will just be more government intrusion in how they run their farms. But the USDA says it's only providing another service, not forcing farmers to do anything new. Back on his farm, Terry Jones welcomes the government's effort. He says farmers need all the help they can get dealing with climate change.
It's almost a matter of national security that we stay ahead of the curve. We can overcome it, but it's going to take research, sharing information, and willingness to not only use common sense, but also think outside the box.
A seventh generation of Joneses is now playing on the farm. Terry Jones hopes the climate hubs will help keep them and future generations working this land. And who knows, maybe Jones's grandchildren will marvel at what he once grew here. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
When you're a farmer working the land, it speaks to you in many different ways. Grapes that are turned into wine tell the tale of the soil they're grown in, and cheese tells the tale of the cows it came from and the grass those cows ate. But cheese also carries other stories that only someone like Matt Rubiner understands. Rubiner is a cheesemonger in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, but he used to spend his time in academia as a military historian and analyst.
Yeah, I always seemed like cagey, like I was a spy or something, but it was military affairs. Mostly technology sort of stuff, you know, what's the newest and greatest weapon the Chinese were coming up with. And I was doing that, things that seemed cool, and I was just a young analyst, war games and things like that, you know, where you're strategizing, you know, what crazy things could happen in the world 10, 20, 30 years down the line. And there was intellectual stimulation to the extent that I'm capable of that, but there wasn't a sensual passion that you had, and, you know, and it's like, oh, I got to do something else. What am I going to do? And, you know, porn star was disreputable, and I wasn't qualified to be a major league relief pitcher, so pick to cheese. When I first got in the business and somebody said to me, it was like, okay, there's two key questions you need to ask about cheese, to understand cheese. Why do you make cheese? And what cheese do you make? And the answers are, you make cheese to preserve milk. And what cheese do you make? You make cheese that the land tells you to make. If you go to southern Italy, what kind of cheeses are you going to make? The land is poor. It's land of figs and olive oil. They'd have to reach deep into the arid soil and, you know, to whatever sweetness they can pull from the earth. And it's too poor a country for cattle, but you need these browsing, sure-footed sheep. Goats, too, but goats aren't typical of Italy because the, you know, Saracen invaders into Europe didn't settle those areas, so they didn't bring their goats with them, which are, you know, so I was a military historian, so that any time I can combine conquest and cheese, it's always. So the sheep are the animal that thrive there, and the cheese they make is pecorino, and that's what it is. So you can taste the pecorino, and you're tasting history, you're tasting culture, you're tasting, you know, you go to the Loire Valley in France, and there's these, all these, each town has its own wonderful little goat cheese with its whimsical shape, a pyramid, a log, a little disc, and you taste these things and you understand history, but then you realize that the goats weren't indigenous to this place. They were an introduction of the invading armies that, you know, when the armies retreated, the culture, some of their culture stayed, and you can look at and see that there were battles in this particular town, and the battles are the same names as the cheeses. Sound too pretentious, but it speaks of a tradition. It must have come from this particular geology. It must have come from this particular climate. It must have come from people who had this sort of food way or this particular diet. And when I see a piece of cheese, it is just a pure expression of the place from which it came.
Yep, sometimes cheese is more than just fermented milk. Amazing stuff. Matt Rubiner, former defense analyst, now a cheesemonger in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, a Guatemalan immigrant remembers crossing the U.S. border as a child 30 years ago.
All I wanted to get out of this, from what I understood, was that I was going to have a chance, that I was going to sleep with my shoes off, that nobody was going to come to my house with guns and kill my family.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org. And by Lookout, working to protect people and organizations from mobile threats with 50 million users worldwide. More information at lookout.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. We've been devoting a lot of time on the show recently to Iraq and the fight there between the extremist group ISIS and the Iraqi government. We've heard about the rising concern in Washington about the country possibly falling apart. We've reported about the dismay and fear in northern Iraq as ISIS has taken over key cities like Fallujah and Mosul, although we've also heard that not everyone there has a negative view of the Sunni militants. But we haven't really heard from anyone who lives there and is now living under ISIS. Today, I did, though. I spoke with a Sunni resident of Mosul. I'll call him Ahmed, but that's not his real name. We've changed it for his safety. Ahmed told me ISIS militants are acting like the authorities now in Mosul.
They are guarding the banks. They are protecting the governmental departments. They told the officers and employees to get back to their works. and to get back to the normal life.
Right. And is ISIS giving civil servants salaries right now?
No, no. They're not giving salaries. But they said that when we go to Baghdad, when we get Baghdad, when we get al-Maliki out of Iraq, you will receive your salaries.
Do you support ISIS's goal of getting Maliki out of power?
Actually, al-Maliki has oppressed us to the degree that you and the world do not know. You see some pictures in the TV about Iraq, but you don't know what's the reality. Here in Iraq, after 2003, we have witnessed murder every day, bomb attacks every day, and every day one of our friends and relatives get killed by unknown groups. And we are asking, who are these groups? And al-Maliki military forces has the gun that the people do not have. So who are killing these persons?
Just tell me, what are the ISIS fighters like when you meet them in person?
Actually, I didn't meet them in person. Just sometimes we saw them in the streets.
Are they frightening? Are they scary?
Scary?
Yeah.
No. No, actually, they seem to be good people. They use very good behavior with people. And they always say, don't be scared and don't fear anything. We came here to protect you and to get the oppression out of Iraq.
Do you support ISIS, Ahmed?
No, we don't support them. But they promised us that we will not hear a single bullet sound in Mosul. And this is what happened. We didn't hear a bullet since the military forces got out of Mosul. They got peace to Mosul. The security situation is stable. But we don't know who are they exactly.
Mm.
You know, so we don't care. We are the people, the normal people. We don't care if they are ISIS or al-Maliki. We want peaceful life here. We don't need more murder. As I told you, every day crying and every day blood in the streets, we get bored of this issue.
Do you think Iraq is going to split apart?
Actually, we don't know. The majority of people now in Mosul are talking about that. We will accept that to stop the bleeding. We don't to be separated and isolated from the Shia brothers. They are our brothers. But this is the solution to stop the bleeding.
Tell me, if you had a message for the United States, for the White House, what would it be?
I will tell them, please help us and please solve this issue politically. Please involve yourselves to stop the murder, to stop our bleeding. Please, Mr. Obama, we want that from you because you always have the solution, okay? We want to solve this issue with negotiations. We don't need more bleeding.
Ahmed, thanks very much for your time. Very nice to meet
you. You're welcome, Mr. Marco. Thank you. Thank you very much.
That was Ahmed, not his real name. He's a resident of Mosul in northern Iraq. He was telling me about life there since ISIS militants took control of the city. Another story we've been hearing a lot about lately, the wave of migrant children, mostly from Central America, who've been making their way alone across the U.S.-Mexico border. For some, this is deja vu. Back in the 1980s, huge numbers of Guatemalans and Salvadorans fled to the U.S. to escape civil war back home. Here's more from the Fronteras Public Radio Collaborative and reporter Jude Joffe Block.
John Fife used to be the pastor here at Tucson Southside Presbyterian Church.
We're located in the oldest and poorest barrio in Tucson.
Back in the 80s, Fife became worried about the civil wars in Central America. Guatemalans and Salvadorans were fleeing military-led massacres and death squads.
Everyone in the international community said to the United States, these people are refugees. The conditions they're fleeing justify a grant of political asylum to them. And the United States government said no.
Almost all of these immigrants were denied asylum initially. Fife knew deportation back to their countries could be deadly. That's when a fellow activist approached him with a proposal.
and basically said, John, I don't think we have any choice except to help people cross the border without being captured by Border Patrol.
So Fife and about 20 other Tucson activists basically became pro bono smugglers. Fife says the first time he had to think hard about it.
Am I willing to go to jail for a year or two in order to save this family from deportation to death?
They help migrants get from northern Mexico to this very church in Tucson. Fife opens the door to a simple room, just a polished cement floor and a kitchen.
And this used to have 50 to 60 people just sleeping on the floor every night when we began.
In 1982, the church told the federal government it was providing sanctuary to these Central American immigrants and shielding them from deportation.
Their response was, if you do that, we'll indict you.
Even so, the sanctuary movement spread to other churches and synagogues around the country. An underground railroad formed to shuttle immigrants from the U.S.-Mexico border to as far north as Canada. The federal government did prosecute Fife and others, but the sanctuary activists countersued. And by the early 1990s, public policy had shifted.
The government agreed to stop all deportations to El Salvador and Guatemala, and they agreed to a whole series of reforms of the political asylum process.
I can proudly say that Sanctuary Rocks, that it's because of them that I'm alive.
Patricia Barceló was a scared 12-year-old from Guatemala when her family crossed into Arizona in 1985. Her parents were union organizers and were being targeted by the right-wing military in power in Guatemala at the time. She remembers meeting John Fife her first night in the U.S. Today she's 40 years old, works at a hospital, and has a teenage son.
I remember when I was crossing the border, all I wanted to get out of this, from what I understood, was that I was going to have a chance, that I was going to sleep with my shoes off, that nobody was going to come to my house with guns and kill my family.
Now, seeing the current headlines of children and families fleeing Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador in big numbers brings back some of those memories.
I have that sense of guilt that not everybody in my country got out. A lot of them that needed to get out got killed. They didn't have the same chance that I did. And I think that the kids coming up right now are just asking for an opportunity to survive, to have a home and a safe home.
What is happening now has a lot of parallels to the 1980s.
Again, John Fife.
Death threats and killings and massacres.
The key difference today, Fife says, is that it's organized crime driving the violence. And as for what he believes should happen now, Fife wants to see a revival of the sanctuary movement. It could start with his old church. Last month, Southside Presbyterian gave sanctuary publicly to the first immigrant in more than 20 years. For The World, I'm Jude Joffe Block, Tucson.
Tomorrow, we'll hear from a United Nations official who's been talking to kids about what it's like to cross the border alone. Okay, we've got some World Cup news to get to now. It seems all the talk in Brazil is about teeth, specifically the ones belonging to Uruguay's star striker Luis Suarez. That's because Suarez apparently bit Italian defender Giorgio Chiellini during a match yesterday. The referee, whose nickname, and this is for real, the ref's name is Dracula. He didn't catch the incident, even though Chiellini showed him a bite mark on his shoulder. Now, Suarez is a repeat offender. He's bitten opponents on the field two times in the past, so fans watching yesterday's game on a giant outdoor screen in Rio were not actually all that surprised.
He's a pit bull. He's a pit bull. He has to be out of the World Cup, period.
Soccer's governing body FIFA has opened disciplinary proceedings against Luis Suarez that could result in a long suspension for the striker. So Uruguay did advance to the round of 16 by beating Italy yesterday, but the World Cup may already be over for Suarez. Our colleague at BBC Mundo, Roberto Bello, is from Uruguay. He's in London now and watched the game there on TV. So how did he react when he saw Suarez apparently sinking his teeth into that defender?
Oh, he was not again. That was quite disappointing, to be honest. But the guy has got quite prominent teeth. So even if he didn't intend it to cause any harm, you know, if you get in contact with him, you probably get hurt anyway. But the replay, you know, leaves very little space for doubt. And, of course, you know, my heart sank a little bit because he's such a, you know, great player and it's not the first time. So basically, he's in trouble.
Well, Roberto, as you said, I mean, twice before this has happened, this is Suarez's third time biting an opponent. It's kind of led to a dubious reputation for him in the professional leagues. But in Uruguay, he's got a different reputation, doesn't he? He's kind of a family man, a national hero.
Yeah, that's it. Actually, the guys, you know, you see all aspects of him, you know, and he's a really good guy. He comes from a very humble background. There's nothing wrong except, well, I mean, maybe he would benefit from some counseling of some sort. But, you know, everything else you see around the guy is, you know, there's nothing wrong with him.
I mean, biting somebody, that is like the classic act of a spoiled brat. But maybe you can tell us what people in the U.S. don't understand about Luis Suarez and where he grew up.
Well, he grew up in Salto, which is a small town in northwest Uruguay. And in that sense, it's it's a typical story of a guy who, you know, very humble backgrounds, who has gone all the way through being a really good player. Everywhere you see around the country, you know, posters, etc., he's kind of the key figure. I mean, everybody, you know, even there's lots of Uruguayan fans now following Liverpool because of Luis Suarez. But well, you know, just in case, I have to, you know, clarify that biting is not at all a common thing in my country. Some people were joking that maybe he was, you know, there was this story as well that the Brazilians confiscated this, you know, 39 kilograms of dulce de leche, which is like, you know, caramel spread. And, you know, maybe they were joking. You see what happens, you know, you remove the sweet from him and he got hungry. But if you realize there are so many, you know, kind of these characters or these instances in world football, remember, you know, Zidane's head, the hand of God from Maradona, now is Suarez's teeth. So basically, what is indignation today, it might be football history tomorrow.
Are you supporting Uruguay in this World Cup?
Yes, I am supporting Uruguay, definitely. Mm.
So what kind of dilemma does Luis Suarez present for you personally if you're rooting for this national team and you've got this kind of misbehaving guy with teeth?
Well, I assume that he might not be in the team in the following matches. So I think also it would be a good opportunity for all the other players to show off. You can imagine that when you have such a big figure in a team, everybody else is kind of eclipsed by this person. So, as we say in Spanish, well, there's no bad thing that doesn't come for a good one. So, in this case, of course, the chances of Uruguay will be smaller, you know, statistically. I mean, we might be losing a fantastic player like Luis Suarez, but maybe it's the opportunity for other ones who, you know, next to this giant are, you know, eclipsed and they can show off and, well, who knows?
Roberto Bello with our friends at BBC Mundo. Thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Who Suarez got for a dentist? That's what I want to know. More World Cup coming up in just a minute. We'll hear from Roger Bennett, one half of the Men in Blazers soccer podcast. Roger, by the way, saw the whole biting thing coming. Before the World Cup, Roger used cupcakes adorned with all the World Cup nations' flags to guess how each team would do. And let's just say he knew something was up when he took a bite out of Uruguay's cupcake.
Mm. This one tastes like Luis Suarez's favorite dish, human flesh.
That soccer gallows humor for you. Disturbing. This is The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're back with The World and with our friend Roger Bennett, one half of the Men in Blazers soccer podcast. You might recall that Roger told us weeks ago that the U.S. will win the World Cup. So let's find out what he thinks now on the eve of a decisive Game 3 for the U.S. against Germany. Rogers in Rio, by the way, apparently still rocking that blazer.
Well, you know, even when the empire was declining, the English never took off their blazers. I think decency and standards must be maintained at all times. But I must say, like any Englishman in the heat of Rio, I've developed a really rather pleasant farmer's tan. I mean, the heat is no laughing matter. This U.S. team have been drawn in this group of death. They plodded through. They played Ghana, their foe, and they overcame the Ghanaians. They then played Portugal, number 4 in the world, and put up an incredible fight. And now they face Germany, number 2 in the world. Once coached by the current coach of the US team, it's a little bit like the Godfather. And the big question is less, how are the Germans going to attack them? And it's more, can they physically rebound in the couple of days they've had to recover? And can they, Marco, mentally recover from being a minute from one of the great sporting achievements by any kind of American team? This was Miracle on Ice. This was Joe Carter's walk-off home run.
Yeah, but as you say, those Germans look pretty darn good. I mean, classically, technically, German play. And I know there's been this talk of match fixing in the background. So this next thing may be kind of hard for some people to absorb. Conspiracy theories that U.S. coach Klinsmann will make some kind of gentleman's agreement with the German team because, right, Germany and the U.S. both just need to pull out a tie tomorrow and they can move ahead. So what do you think about
that?
Yeah,
I was in Germany with Jürgen when he trained with the team 3 months ago. And it was amazing to watch Jürgen Klinsmann, a German, speak to the German press in German about German players who he'd brought over to the American team while he was wearing the American badge and was about to lead the American team into a World Cup battle against Germany. So it's kind of wheels within wheels. Identity-wise, it's very complex for us, for him. And in football, there is a tradition. In 1982, Algeria had a great chance of going through the group, but West Germany and Austria fixed the score at 1-0 to West Germany, which allowed both of those teams to progress at Algeria's expense. If you look on YouTube at the game, you can see footballers at a World Cup just knocking the ball casually around midfield, neither side trying to score after the first goal had gone in. So there is a World Cup tradition, but there's also another storyline, is that Jürgen Klinsmann was the German coach. He led them on a darling run to the semi-finals of the 2006 World Cup. But a lot of the Germans think he's a Californian, an American, a dreamer, and not a good coach. And there's a feeling that a lot of these Germans would like nothing more than to take on Jürgen Klinsmann's team and give them a bare bottom spanking before the eyes of the world. So we will see. Either way, it's going to be a spectacle, Marco, and not to be missed.
Roger, look at us talking soccer with such ease on an American radio show like The World. I mean, so much has changed from that time in 1990 when you were a camp counselor in Maine and trying to find somewhere to watch the World Cup that year being played in Italy. Things have changed, haven't they?
You know, to me, win or lose tomorrow, that is the great legacy of this World Cup run. The ratings, we've already won the World Cup in my estimation, Marco.
And on that note, and mercifully with no mention of my poor Cameroonian Lions and their loss on Monday to Brazil, we deftly thank you for your time and thoughts, Roger.
They're still indomitable, Marco.
Roger Bennett, one half of the soccer podcast Men in Blazers, on the line with us from Rio. Enjoy the games, Roger.
Thank you so much. You too.
And we have one more World Cup-related item for you today. For this one, I took a little trip to the rainforest, as in the rainforest right here in Boston at the Franklin Park Zoo, to meet our World Cup-predicting ocelot, Izzy. So this is very exciting. We're going to have another Izzy pick in a few moments for tomorrow's match between the USA and Germany. We're going to see how Izzy rules on what's going to happen in 24 hours.
This is PR1 to Forest 10. We are ready for Izzy to come out.
Oh, here he comes.
And the stage is set. We're now just waiting for Izzy. Oh, he's going straight for the USA. There was no hesitation. Saw that leaf and just started munching. Wait a minute. Walking now away from the USA after one taste of the leaf. Izzy is on a rock and now sniffing Germany and munching Germany. Munching a leaf, a German leaf. Munched a U.S. leaf, munched a German leaf. Now wait, one leaf and one leaf. And now moving down toward the water and taking another bite of Germany. You know, if you look at those leaves of goals, the U.S. just lost to Germany. And we have Izzy zookeeper Janine Jackal in the studio with us today. Welcome to our zoo, Janine.
Welcome. It's good to be here.
We don't have any bars, but we do have a lot of glass around here.
Smells good.
I'll take that as a compliment.
All right.
Izzy did knock down and walk over the Germany sign. Can we see that as an omen, maybe?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. I think he was just taking out Germany and going for USA. That's my interpretation anyway.
I wanted to talk a little bit about Izzy, but ocelots in general. Izzy is an ocelot. Some have described ocelots as dwarf leopards, but there are many subspecies. But basically, is that the deal? It's a small kind of leopard.
Yes, it's definitely. Some people call them small leopards, or there's 9 subspecies of ocelot. But, you know, scientists debate exactly what is a subspecies and who are different in there. But they're basically found in this country, in the lower portions of Texas, all the way into Central and South America, all the way down as far as Argentina. So they're found in a very, very broad area. So they break up into smaller groups depending on where the areas are and how much habitat loss is in their country. And so they're found in different pockets here and there. So.
And it helps that Brazil has native ocelots as well?
Brazil has native ocelots.
But
absolutely.
They're endangered, I gather.
They are endangered in a lot of parts of the world. In some parts, they're fairly plentiful. I believe the Brazilian population is – that numbers are going down due to hunting and habitat loss. But there's still a fairly good amount in the Amazon basin. This country, definitely numbers are very, very low. And in zoos, there aren't very many. There's only about 30 Brazilian ocelots in North America in the zoos. So for us, it's important to try to get the numbers up.
I gather Isidoro has fathered a number of baby ocelots?
Yes. He's had at least 5 babies out there, and he's had 3 males and 2 females.
Okay, so Izzy's keeping the species alive.
He is doing really well.
Very good. What do they eat? Because we've seen Izzy go to these potted bamboo stalks and eat those leaves. A vegetarian?
No, he's actually a meat eater. Mm. All cats are carnivores, as well as the ocelot. In the wild, they would eat mice and other small rodents. They might eat birds and pretty much anything they can catch. In zoos, we feed them a carnivore meat that we purchase for them. That's all the vitamins, everything they need in it. They do like the grass, as you know, cats. Domestic cats like grass, too.
Well, Janine Jackal, curator of the Rainforest at the Franklin Park Zoo here in Boston, thanks for dropping by. Great to meet you.
You're welcome. It's great to be here. Thank you.
You can get the latest from Izzy, minus the catnip. Follow this oracle-like Brazilian cat on Twitter at IzzyPix. That's IzzyPix. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. RitaAllen.org. By PRI's New Voices Fund, whose donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, MacFound.org. The PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation. And by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security at carnegie.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.